Everybody, and welcome to Every Horror Movie on Netflix, the podcast where we watch, review, and discuss every horror movie on Netflix. I'm Patrick. I'm back from Italy, and we have a very special episode. Today, we are going to be reviewing the new end film, Anna Kendrick's directorial debut, Woman of the Hour. And here to discuss this film with me today, I've got two very special guests. Say hello to Allison with a Y.
Hello, everyone.
And say hello to returning champion, Dr. Katie.
Hi.
Thank you both for being here today. I know you both have a passion for true crime, and so I thought you were the people to have here today to consult on this film.
Yes, very much so. I love true crime, but I think it... You know, knowing some of the history and the true story behind this movie definitely colored how I watched it going in.
Yeah. And I'm going to be leaning on you both for that today. We'll get to that in a minute. But before we dive in, I want to kind of do our standard horror catch-up. Allison, have you been enjoying anything spooky so far since we are now deep into spooky season?
Well, I've been listening to the same old spooky podcasts that I always do. Unfortunately, I don't have any new recommendations there. However, I have been working on a lovely little project with Patrick where we are watching every Jaws movie. There are four of them. Who knew? Mm-hmm. And that has been an interesting time. And you all get to hear about it pretty soon.
That's right. We've got... You're probably going to be hearing a little bit more from me on Amon in the weeks and months to come, because I'm going to be doing some little side missions, like the one that we're doing today, or the Every Jaws Movie Ever episode that Allison and I are working on. That'll be coming your way before Halloween. You know, Allison, I guess not to spoil the episode we're about to do, but any early hot takes on the three of four Jaws movies we've watched so far?
A lot of my thoughts on the movies are very colored from somebody who loves sharks and who grew up watching Shark Week. So just be prepared for a lot of hard opinions on the portrayal of sharks.
Well, yeah, hopefully some shark facts to throw it back.
Absolutely.
To Chris's diving facts and shark facts that he offered us on 47 Meters Down. Katie, how about you? How's your spoopy season going?
I love spoopy season. I feel like I've watched some horror movies, but nothing I can remember off the top of my head, but have gotten to have some real life spoopy experiences recently. I went on my first ever paranormal investigation with Allison with a Y.
Oh yeah, we did that.
Yeah. At the Anatomy of Death Museum in Mount Clemens, Michigan. Definitely a must see if you're into the spoopy and unusual. And it was just a great experience.
Did you commune with any spirits?
We think so. We think so.
It certainly felt that way.
Yeah. There, if not paranormal, there were definitely some uncanny experiences and interactions through the technology that the lead investigator brought along.
Interesting. All right. So we've got some Jaws movies. We've got a paranormal investigation. I want to throw out a couple quick notes for my own horror catch-up here before we get into the movie. I've been doing so much reading and watching and whatever for spooky season. I'm not going to get into it all this episode, especially since we have a few more episodes coming up. But I do want to give a quick shout-out to The Substance. Did you get to see The Substance, Katie?
Mm-mm, no. Okay.
It's amazing. I think you would enjoy it as a lover of gore and gross things on screen. Yes. Allison set this one out. They are not an enjoyer of the gore and gross things.
No, thank you.
Okay, I'm gonna have to check that out for sure.
It's incredible. I just want to add my voice to the choir that Chris and Steven started last episode. It's a weird, wonderful, delightful, blackly funny body horror thing. If you love Cronenberg, you'll you'll love this. And I just kind of like Chris and Steven said last episode, I just want to give it a shout out because I feel like it's something that is so unconventional and so weird, and it is fading from a surprisingly wide release already. So if you haven't seen it, go buy a ticket, check that out in the theater. The other thing that I wanted to mention is I dropped my own horror comic yesterday.
It's so good. It's so good, everyone. I was the first reader of it, proud first reader, and I can't recommend it enough.
Thank you. Thank
and I'm
you.
Not just saying that because I'm biased about the author and illustrator.
And I just got my copy today and cannot wait.
Yay. Thank you both. I'm very excited to have it out in the world. I've been wanting to publish a comic for a long time. I did write and draw it. It's a kind of psychological graphic nightmare, as I titled it, about a couple who comes home to their house and finds another family is now living in their house, and they have to figure out what's going on with that. I would love for any of our listeners to check it out. Feel free to just message any of our social media accounts and I'll hook you up with a copy. I'll mail you one for $5 if you are interested. And you can find us on social media at Amoncast, EHMONcast. And the title of the comic, which I don't think I mentioned, is Our House. So let's move on to the topic of the hour, which is Woman of the Hour. Again, as I said, Anna Kendrick's directorial debut. She plays Cheryl Bradshaw, who is a woman who was on the dating competition game show, The Dating Game, back in the 70s. And this show, if you're not familiar with the format, because I actually wasn't familiar with the format myself until we watched it yesterday, is a woman goes on the show. There are three bachelors hidden behind a partition. She asks them questions without being able to see their faces and chooses which of the three she wants to go on a date with at the end. So this woman, Cheryl Bradshaw, went on this show, and one of the three contestants was a serial killer named Rodney Alcala. And it's an interesting narrative because it's centered around Cheryl Bradshaw, Anna Kendrick's character, but we also get woven into the story, I think, three different timelines and narratives of other women who he attacked and killed, both before and after, I believe, this dating game encounter. So it's kind of an unusual structure, but I found it very effective. I'm curious, since we talked about this at the top of the show, you know, what was each of your familiarities with this this case before seeing the movie? I had never heard of this guy or the dating game killer or anything until I read about this movie. So what did you each know about it?
I had heard of him. I was familiar with Rodney Alcala and the fact that he had appeared on The Dating Game in the middle of his murder spree in the late 70s. And maybe this is a spoiler. Yeah, but he was the bachelor selected by the bachelorette. But that, and I'm sure this saved her life, she never went on the date with him. She found him creepy.
I think that was her exact words, actually.
Yeah. That she was very uncomfortable with him, felt that he was creepy, didn't want to go on the date. But I didn't know much about the victims before and after, just that this had kind of occurred both before and after his appearance on TV, which is so bizarre to me.
Insane. Allison, what did you know about this whole situation?
Similar to Katie, I had heard of Rodney Alcala. I knew of him as the dating game killer. And I didn't know how prolific of a serial murderer he was. And I certainly didn't know that there are also so many potential other victims of him. I've definitely listened to, you know, like a My Favorite Murder episode about him and probably some other true crime podcasts that mentioned him. But I certainly didn't know the extent. And I didn't know that he was the one who was picked by the woman on the date, which is just wild to think about. So, it was enlightening. And also, it made me curious to understand the real story behind the movie at the same time.
But I think the fact that he was the bachelor selected, that he, you know, quote unquote, won the dating game, speaks to or relates to how successful he was as a serial killer. He could be charming on the surface, almost like a Ted Bundy, right? He seems like this attractive, charming guy, but he's harboring this deep secret and these sadistic needs.
Yeah, because his bit in the movie and in real life was he was a photographer and he would kind of lure people in by saying, "You're so beautiful, you know, can I take pictures of you?" And the actor who portrays him in the film, whose name escapes me right at the moment, I think does an incredible job of just showing how charismatic this guy was and how he just knew how to manipulate people. There are multiple scenes where we see him pulling that shtick on people and it's like, yep, I get how that worked.
Can I speak on that whole shtick for a minute?
Oh, about yeah.
Photography.
You've had near encounters with potential real life Rodney Alcala's.
When I was in like my early mid, probably just throughout my 20s, when I was younger and, you know, put a little more effort into my appearance, I used to be every once in a while approached by men in public, strangers who would hand me like a business card or something and tell me that they wanted to photograph me. And, you know, there was always a moment of flattery, but thank God I have the brain that I do, because right after that flash of flattery, I'm thinking in my head, absolutely not. This is how I die. This is 100% how I'm going to die if I go anywhere with this man or meet this man anywhere. So no, I don't need to be photographed.
Yeah.
Yep. Nope.
Good call.
No, thank you.
Good call.
So that hit a little close to home. Ugh.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you were talking about the number of his actual victims, and I was just reading up on this online. I mean, because there are a number that are definitively established that he killed,
yes.
But also I think it said, actually, I believe this may have even been in the crawl at the end of the movie, mm-hmm. that it's suspected, some people think he killed up to 100 people.
130.
Insane.
Yeah.
So I think this movie is kind of interesting, and Anna Kendrick has spoken about how she wanted to, I mean, she didn't write the script, but she talked about how it interested her because it took kind of an unusual perspective on this, in that it wasn't like aspiring, intrepid young detective cracks this case kind of story. And it is very focused on several of the victims and this one near victim, Cheryl Bradshaw. Did that strike you all, and how did it strike you, if so?
Yeah, I prefer a victim-centric or survivor-centric telling of these stories. I think that there has been a better pattern with the telling of stories of these serial murderers and just regular murderers, where it's more centered around the victims or in some cases the survivors. And I think that's important, because instead of glorifying and uplifting the story of these people who do these horrible things, you are forced to put yourself more in the place of these people who went through these horrifying experiences and met these horrible ends. And I appreciated that. And I think what I also appreciated about this movie was it didn't go too graphic. It showed you enough where you knew that it was horrifying, but it didn't feel gross in its portrayal of these crimes.
Yeah, it's pretty restrained, all things considered, when it comes to that.
Yeah, and that was a point that I really wanted to talk about too, is like, as we've established on the show, I'm a bit of a gore fiend.
Mm-hmm.
But in this movie, they treated the deaths and the violence very differently, and like Allison said, very restrained. And I thought, in a movie like this that tells the true story and has characters that are based on real victims, that to show their deaths in any other way feels exploitative,
mm-hmm.
and disrespectful.
Mm-hmm.
And so by removing the shock value of the kill or the violence, it felt more tactful, mm-hmm. and respectful to the people upon which this was based.
Yeah. for sure. Yeah, because, I mean, you see scenes of him, like, slamming women into the ground, but it's shot with, I don't know, you understand the inhumanity and the violence that's being perpetrated on them without, like, seeing somebody's, you know, head split open or something like that, which I think would just feel sort of prurient and just inappropriate, I think, to this, given how real all these people are. And I was just kind of surprised and impressed with, you know, obviously the selling point for this, the hook, is Anna Kendrick being on the dating game with a killer. But I mean, that's, you know, I don't know, I would estimate maybe only about half of the runtime really focuses on her. Like, she is ostensibly our protagonist. But by the end, like, one of his other victims kind of winds up being almost as much of a protagonist to this as she is. And I was kind of impressed and surprised at how much at least one or two of these other victims are really fleshed out as characters and incredible actors portraying them and incredible thought given to making them more than just, like, another tick on his, like, kill list or whatever. I was very impressed with that. What did we think about Anna Kendrick in this? Are we Anna Kendrick fans?
I've always been neutral on Anna Kendrick. I've never disliked her. I've never gone out of my way to, like, see anything she's in. But I thought she was very capable. And, yeah, I think she's a talented actress, you know. And she did good. She did a great job with, like, what she had to work with, which is kind of just basing off of one episode of The Dating Game.
Katie, Anna Kendrick fan?
Yes. Me I too. Love Anna Kendrick. I think she's so clever and funny and, like, relatable. Mm-hmm. Like, I want to be friends with Anna Kendrick. She seems cool. So I think having her central to this, like, a familiar face at the center of the story is kind of like a grounding point. But going into it, like, seeing the previews and having it build as Woman of the Hour with her at the center, I was actually worried that I wasn't going to like this movie. Because I knew going into it that this Cheryl Bradshaw had been on the show, that Rodney had won, but that they didn't go on the date. And so going into the movie and seeing the previews, I thought that this movie was actually going to be, like, a fictionalized account of them going on a date because it showed them in the bar. And so I was honestly really skeptical going in because I thought that this was going to be different than what it was. And I was...
That they were kind of going to spin out this fiction that didn't happen.
Yeah, that this woman who was not a victim, did not go on the date with him, was going to be turned into the hero of the story, or it was going to be a fictionalized account that took away from the stories of the other victims, of the actual victims. Fortunately, that was not the case, and I thought that the balance was nice. It was better than what I thought it was going to be.
I agree, and I've been a huge fan of Anna Kendrick since I saw Up in the Air, which I think was, I'm sure not her debut role, but definitely her breakout, and I thought she was just incredible in that, and I think she's perfect for this story, because she has that, like, she's tough, she exudes a lot of toughness, but also, like, seems, there's like, a fragility to her, too, where you're worried for sure about her being alone with this fucking guy,
right? You know? She's such a petite woman, which just inherently brings a level of vulnerability, and so she's able to show that she's tough but also, like, at risk at the same time, just because she inhabits the body she inhabits.
Yeah,
very much so.
Yeah, I mean, on that note too, let's sort of talk about the, I don't know if I want to say gender politics, but just the gender stuff in this movie. I mean, I kind of joked to Allison yesterday, like, the real villain in this movie is the patriarchy, but it's also kind of true. Like, there's really I mean, obviously we have this one central, very evil man who is a murderer, but also pretty much every other man in the movie is a piece of shit. Or at the very best, kind of useless.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You've got like her down the hall neighbor who she thinks is her best bud, but then is trying to put the moves on her. You've got the host of the dating game played by Tony Hale.
Oh my gosh.
Nailed it.
Buster. Love him. And he did nail it. Yep. And he's a piece of shit, just obviously like exploiting the women who are on the show and trying to get her in a tight dress so she's hot for TV. You know, obviously a parade of or the police, various authority figures who the different women try and, you know, expose this whole Rodney Alcala situation to and just get flagrantly ignored. So, you know, there's a lot in here, I think, about the experience of being a woman. And now I'll stop being the man talking about that. How did that sit with y'all?
This is why I don't date a lot. I mean, one of the reasons, right? Like,
this is why you don't play the dating game.
I don't. In real life or on TV, I don't play the dating game. I think every woman has had that experience, like with her neighbor, where you think it's a friend and they want more and there's the pressure there. And then, you know, you see so many stories on Twitter and Reddit of guys like Rodney who don't take it to the extremes that he does. But you notice in most of his interactions with women, he plays the charmer. He plays the quote unquote nice guy. But as soon as he senses rejection from them or disinterest, a switch flips. Mm-hmm. And he becomes angry and aggressive. And I don't know how many Reddit and Twitter stories I've seen of quote unquote nice guys acting that way as soon as they're rejected. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah.
As a woman, this movie felt relatable to some of my experiences for sure. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, as somebody who, you know, was born into the body I was born into, and because of that gets seen a certain way by society and by men and treated a certain way, it was like, I know all this. Like, yeah. You know, I've been treated this, like, every, I mean, other than being murdered or, you know, physically assaulted like that, like, I've been certainly interacted with in most of these ways by men at various points in my life. I have had men get unreasonably angry with me when, you know, I wasn't interested or I didn't even have like the same like timeline of wanting to spend time with them. Like, it just, I've had a lot of violent language, you know, thrown at me. And I'm a pretty tough person and it doesn't phase me the same way it does a lot of others, which I'm grateful for, but it doesn't take away from that experience and it doesn't take away from that threat. And watching it, part of me was, I mean, a lot of me was grateful that I live in the time that I do where we have more awareness. Like, it's not perfect, but there is so much more awareness now and there isn't as much acceptance of women being spoken to or, you know, people that are not just cis men being spoken to in that absolutely degrading manner in just normal everyday conversations. I'm grateful for that.
Yeah. And one of the moments that I continue to think about is when she asks the question to all three bachelors on the dating game, what are girls for? Mm-hmm. And the first bachelor, I think his response was like, for dating and wining and dining. And the second one had much more explicit views on what girls were for. And then Rodney had the best responses, you know, kind of whatever the woman decides. Mm-hmm. But really, under the surface, he had an intention for women as well, and that was to fulfill his insidious and sadistic desires. Mm-hmm. But yes, society a lot of the time tends to think that there are certain purposes or roles for women and girls, and I think it should be up to the women and girls and non-men folk to decide who they are and what they're quote unquote for. Mm-hmm. We're not for anything.
We're not for you.
Hear, hear. Snaps to that.
That being said, it is an exception when it comes to my cats, who are all boys. I absolutely live to serve them, you know,
yeah.
According to them.
Yes, of course.
And I can't convince them otherwise yet.
So I'm, I guess we'll do a spoiler break for this. It feels odd to, since it's a case, it's based on a real story that happened 50 years ago, and it's not like the... It's hard to even say what spoilers, I guess, in this. But I think we've been talking a little more generally about the movie and not quite so much about the details of the narrative. So maybe in the spoiler room we can kind of dig into what happens on the dating game and what we learn at the end of the movie, etc. But before we go there, for, you know, a little more on the general level, so again... Anna Kendrick's directorial debut. Do y'all think she did a good job?
Yeah. I'm for her first time directing, I think it was definitely a success.
I agree. I was actually really knocked out. I think the movie looks great. Mm-hmm. You know, it's well shot. It's tense. Great performances. I think she got great performances out of pretty much everyone involved. You know, it's always weird when someone does, particularly a directorial debut that they also star in, because it's like, okay, well, if you're directing this, like maybe give some shine to somebody else. But again, there are some other, you know, near protagonists in this movie besides her. So I thought she did an impressive job directing herself and directing others in it. What did you think, Katie?
I thought it was really well done. I think there were some clumsy moments, I thought, where things were not explained as well as they could have been. And I think some of there were some issues with the timeline jumping that felt a little clumsy and disjointed to me. Mm-hmm. But also that could be because I'm familiar with the timeline and was trying to line things up. Mm-hmm. And they didn't always line up perfectly. Mm-hmm. So that's also on me.
Yeah, let's dig into that a little more in the spoiler room, because I think I also had some of the same trouble tracking the different timelines, but in the end, it actually had a positive emotional effect on me, mm-hmm. I think. But let's return to that when we get in the spoiler room. All right, so we are going to head to the spoiler room, but before we do that, as always, we're going to rate the movie, view it, cue it, or screw it, and then you can decide if you want to go watch Woman of the Hour for yourself before we dig into a little more of the specific plot details. Katie, would you like to go first? What's your review?
I say this is a view it. I was interested in the story beforehand. This made me learn more about it. Through the watching of this film and then doing the research afterwards. And it's just a really compelling story, brilliant performances, great storytelling. And I think it presented the events in a way that is respectful to the victims, but still conveys the gravity of what happened.
Allison.
I'm also a view it. As somebody who prefers to take in their true crime stories from a more documentary kind of lens and tends to be skeptical of dramatized versions, I was pleasantly surprised. I wasn't actually expecting to like it as much as I did. And I completely agree about the point that it was done. It felt very respectful. Yeah, I think if you like true crime, even if you are more of a documentary person, I think this is absolutely worth the watch.
I'm going to jump on that boat as well. Definitely a view it for me. Again, was really impressed with Anna Kendrick's direction here. The story itself is just so shocking, and it's an interesting story inherently. Our cat Hodor seems to have some opinions on the film as well. I'm not sure if he liked it as much as I did. It's obviously a shocking story that is just an interesting narrative in and of itself, regardless. But I thought this was a really impressive way to dramatize it. I found it very gripping throughout, even though it's not necessarily tense in the way that your average crime thriller is. It feels, I guess, a little slower. And again, because it's not sort of fixating on like sort of prurient detail, it's not like exciting or thrilling in the way that a thriller normally is, but it's still like I was gripped throughout and wondering what was going to happen to all of these people, especially the way the timelines kind of intersect and you're left wondering what's going to happen next to each of these women at various points. So yeah, very impressed. Three viewits. Before we go to the spoiler dating game, I will remind you all, as always, to follow us on social media. We are at Amoncast, EHMONcast, on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also join our Discord community. There's a link to that in the show notes. We have Amon fans and horror fans from all around the world on there who chat about the podcast and all things horror, and it's a really lovely place to hang out. And lastly, please subscribe to the show and leave us a review on your podcast provider of choice. 5 stars only, as Stephen always says. Nothing less tolerated. Only 5-star reviews. We love to see the feedback, but only if it's good. All right, we'll be right back. We're heading down to the spoiler room for Woman of the Hour. Okay, welcome back. We are in the spoiler room for Woman of the Hour, and we're going to kind of dig into some more of the plot specifics. Obviously, the big sort of centerpiece of this film is Cheryl's appearance on the dating game. And there are some creative liberties taken with this. Mm-hmm. Obviously, she has a very sharp and very funny kind of back and forth with the bachelors. She gets fed up with the kind of showmanship and the fakeness that she's expected to portray on the show and goes off script, starts coming up with her own questions, like what are girls for, as Katie referenced before, which Cheryl did not do in real life, but it's very funny and works very well in the context of the movie. How did you guys feel about the dating game sequence in general? It felt very tense and high energy, and yeah, it just gets under your skin in, I thought, a very effective way. What did you all think?
I loved the progression of her going out there, being fairly dazed by the whole thing, and then throughout the experience, gaining more confidence and taking back her autonomy in it. As much as I understand that that is not rooted in historical fact, I appreciate that narrative device in it. I think it worked very well with how the rest of the story, even around the happenings outside of the dating game, kind of worked.
Mm-hmm. There's also another kind of interesting, as far as I can tell from the research I did, fictionalized but I think impactful element that they add to the whole dating game narrative, where there's this character named Laura. And I know this hit you, Allison, particularly hard. Do you want to kind of explain Laura's role in the story and also how you related to that piece of the plot?
Well, I thought it was such an effective addition to the story, even if it was fictional. So Laura is somebody who comes to watch, be in the dating game audience. So she goes to watch the dating game and she recognizes Rodney Alcala as the man who she believes murdered her very close friend. And she is deeply, deeply emotionally affected by this, to the point where she leaves and she tries to report him to the producers. And eventually she goes to the police and no one believes her. Not her boyfriend, not the people working on the dating game, not the police officers. And it just was such an effective representation of how it doesn't matter how much women try to report these things. They go unbelieved. And I think even more important is Laura was a Black woman. So she's this woman of color who is just deeply dismissed. And I don't think that was an accident, that representation, because as we know, in this country especially, women of color are even more dismissed than white women. And it's really important to highlight that. And so I appreciated that representation as well. And just her desperation at one point, she's like yelling at the cop, why won't anyone believe me? Like, it's just her frustration is so palpable. And she basically, it feels like she represents all of the people probably throughout the 10 years that this man was committing these types of crimes, who tried to stop him, who tried to do the right thing by reporting him, and none of them were believed. And so many people died, and this is so true in this country, that people will report and try to do the right thing and be ignored and not be believed. And dangerous people are allowed to continue to go about their lives, and innocent people are harmed because of it. And so it was a really effective representation.
Absolutely.
Of that.
And it happened with Ted Bundy, with Jeffrey Dahmer, of these charismatic men can't possibly be doing these atrocious things. Women are just crazy.
Or in the case of Jeffrey Dahmer, gay men go ignored.
And I think his neighbor, who was a woman, might have reported suspicion. I know it in the series that was done with Evan Peters, and his neighbor was portrayed by Niecy Nash. Mm-hmm. Again, a black woman who goes unheard. I don't remember how accurate that particular portrayal was, but it's definitely a theme that we see time and time again.
Well, and I think that character works really well, too, because it kind of plays into what I've been talking about the kind of multiple protagonists in this, because she's certainly another one of them, mm-hmm. you know. And I think, again, it just contributes to that. Like, this could have been sort of a race against the clock, like, dating game, trying to catch the killer before he gets off the dating game sort of thing. But it really kind of branches off into these different stories about women who've been affected by this guy in various ways, and really dialing in on their stories and their frustration. There's not really a happy ending for anybody in this, you know. I mean, the guy did eventually get caught, but for any of the women in this, you know, I mean, Cheryl gets out, but it's not, there's not a lot of catharsis to her getting away from him. You know, in the end, there's this tense encounter between the two of them in a parking lot after she's gone out for a drink with him and finally, like, realize this guy is a fuck. And she only gets away because people come out of the studio at the last minute and basically make it so that he can't shove her in the car or kill her in the parking lot, because there are now witnesses suddenly. And that's how she gets away, moves out of L.A. There's not a real happy ending for anybody in this. Anyway, I kind of got away from my point, but I think Laura is another character that works very well. The screenwriter did a nice job fleshing out that character, mm-hmm. you know, real or not. And the actress does an impressive job portraying her, too.
Yeah.
I also, you know, while we're talking about kind of the multiple characters here, want to give a little time to the runaway, whose name does anybody remember the runaway's
name?
Amy. I think the youngest victim, probably, that's portrayed in the film.
That's portrayed in the film.
He killed a 12-year-old,
That was his last supposed victim, yes. Yeah.
This girl is a teenager. My perception was she's like a minor. Still,
she was based on a 15-year-old.
15, okay, yeah. And she, I think, out of the various victims that are portrayed, kind of gets the most story of her mm-hmm. own. And I believe, doesn't it actually end with her story too? How she escapes from him?
Yeah. So, kind of like the last bit of the film is that, I mean, she's a runaway, and he offers to photograph her, blah, blah, blah. He assaults her, and she's very smart, and she forces him to basically empathize with her by her empathizing with him. And because she takes this tactic, she survives long enough to be able to escape, because she gains his trust. And when he goes to stop to go to the bathroom, and this is based off of a true story, this part, mm-hmm. He stops to go to the bathroom. She's able to run away and report him. In real life, he was arrested at this point. However, he made bail.
His mom.
His mom bailed him out. And he went on to murder at least two more people after he was known to kidnap this girl, rape her, and with the intentions of killing her. Mm-hmm. And you don't see the other two victims, but at the end of the film, they do say all of this part that he got out on bail. He killed two more people, one of whom was a 12-year-old girl. And that is how he was finally put away.
Just insane.
It's just, it highlights such the failure of the system that's supposed to protect us and allows these people to go free.
Absolutely. But to this girl who had the incredible presence of mind and bravery and wits and intellect to read the situation and understand how to interact with and manipulate him in order to survive and get out of that situation alive.
Incredible.
That girl is incredible. Mm. I can't even imagine.
Right. Well, and it's an interesting, it's fascinating true story, what happened to her. But, you know, again, there's some creative license, I'm sure, taken here because nobody knows probably exactly what she said to him in real life. But I think it's a really well-written scene when she's trying to, you know, get him out of the desert and into the car again so that she has a chance to escape. It's very well-written. It's very well-performed. And again, I just think kudos to them for creating a character who feels like a character and someone who feels fleshed out and distinct from the other victims that we see. Because again, this could have been done a lot more lazily than it is. And I just, again, appreciate the thought and care that's put into rounding out this character, because you like her and you root for her. And again, it's just like multiple protagonists kind of weaving in and out in this story.
And yeah, shout out to the actress, her depth in that performance, everything that she put into it. That was an incredible performance. I can't imagine as an adult putting together that complex of an emotional performance. Mm-hmm. Big shout out to that actress.
For sure. And this kind of brings me back to your point before, Katie, about the interweaving timelines. And you mentioned kind of getting a little confused at times by them. And I was too, because at the end, I actually asked Allison, I was like, okay, wait, so that was in 1970, whatever year. And I was like, what year is The Dating Game, you know?
Yeah, so I was thinking for a while that I was watching her storyline that it was 1977 with some of the others, which was pre-Dating Game. So I couldn't
remember,
does she get out of this alive or not?
Right.
But no, it was, I believe, 1979 that this was portrayed. So I got a little, there were a lot of timelines to keep straight.
If you watch it, definitely pay close attention to when they introduce a new section and they have a timestamp for like the year, because that's important for keeping track of things.
And a location stamp. There are also murders and events that happen in New York and Los Angeles.
Wyoming too.
That
was the first one.
Yeah. Which I don't know if that was based on a...
That was based on a real one. Yeah. He had victims in Wyoming, or at least a victim.
But to me, the somewhat disorienting timelines actually worked as more of a gut punch at the end when I was like, wait, no. Amy was before or after The Dating Game?
After.
Yeah, it happened after The Dating Game. Like, this guy got away with so much more shit. And so it made the revelation of what Allison just shared about, like, the arrest, him getting out on bail, and then getting rearrested. For me, as someone who had no knowledge of the story, it worked even better because I had lost track of the timestamps. I was almost like, I might have liked this better if it didn't have the timestamps, because then it hits harder at the end when you actually figure out the chronology of this and how much shit he had done before the TV show, and then how much he still managed to go on to do after the TV show. Mm-hmm. It hit extra hard for me because of the slightly disorienting effect of the multiple timelines. So I actually liked that. I agreed that I got confused, but it made the ending actually work better for me because I was confused. It was interesting. Well, before we wrap up, I kind of want to bring it back to something you and I, Katie, were talking about while we took our little spoiler room break before, and you had some interesting thoughts on how this kind of fits into the broader picture of violence against women in horror and how that's often treated in horror and how it's differently treated here.
You know, my train of thought had come from how the murders in this movie were treated differently than murders in a lot of horror movies and true crime based movies, in that they were more restrained, which I feel was, you know, in respect of the victims. But then I guess thinking about, in these cases, what is the most respectful way to talk about or portray what happened to these people? Is it to acknowledge but not show what happened to them, because just knowing that it happened is enough? Or is it better to show what happened to these people, to really understand the full horror of what happened to them? But is there a way to do that in a way that's not exploitative? Because we see so much exploitation of violence against women and female suffering in horror, and it's done for shock value and entertainment. And I don't know that there is a way to do it in a way that's not exploitative or that is disrespectful to the victim. So I think that what Anna Kendrick did here was really the best route, and avoiding perpetuating the violence and indignity that happened to these women.
No, I think we were talking yesterday about, you know, I chose this movie because I was just looking like, okay, what new horror, Netflix horror is coming on in October? And this popped up on some list that, you know, whatever aggregator website put together. I don't know that this is actually categorized as horror on Netflix. I think it might be under crime or thriller or something. So we may actually be breaking the rules of the podcast here. Chris is going to come down on me. But I think it absolutely is horror. You know, it certainly doesn't present violence or this story in the way that you might expect a horror film to, but it is absolutely horrifying. There is a lot of horror experienced by people in the film, and I think that qualifies as much as anything.
And especially knowing that it is true.
Yes.
Is truly horrifying.
Absolutely.
I think we talked about this a long time ago when I was on the podcast, but horror is more of a feeling than anything else. If a film instills in you a feeling of horror, which this film absolutely did, I think then it falls under the umbrella, in the very least.
Yeah.
Does anybody else want to talk about or address that whole exploit? Yeah, because I'd love to hear other people's thoughts on it.
Yeah, I was actually coming right back to it. I mean, I think, you know, still on like sort of the horror note, you know, you and I were talking about, Katie, how we, you know, we love the blood and guts and whatever, but you certainly don't need that to feel horror. And I think this is, this is just sort of a thoughtful, grounded, realistic, and respectful take on something that is still amply horror and horrifying, I think.
If you look it up, obviously, you can find who all of these characters are based off of. But I love that layer of respect by changing names. I think that was really a really powerful and thoughtful move. It feels like there was a lot of thought put into this about, like, we don't need to exploit the suffering of women anymore. We don't need to add to that. What we can do is uplift their voices and tell their stories and humanize them. We can at least do that much.
Yeah. Were all the victims' names fictionalized? Do we know that? So Amy is not a real, that's not a real name.
No, she was based off of Monique Hoyt.
And I know Charlie, that name was changed.
Okay.
She was based on Cornelia Curley, I believe.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like that's appropriate, especially since you're, you know, making, you know, you're taking some creative liberties. You're making some guesses about what happened and who said what to who in the course of these things. So I think that's appropriate, feels appropriate to me.
Yeah, it's not meant to be a documentary, you know.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. It's a dramatization.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you both for joining me for an unusually somber episode of Amon, but I think an appropriately somber episode. It's hard to talk about a movie that deals with awful things that happen to real people, but thank you for watching it with me and navigating this with me today.
Thank you for having us, and also thank you for having a couple of not men on to talk about this story.
Yeah.
You're welcome. My pleasure. All right. Again, follow us on social media at Amoncast, EHMONcast. We want to know what you thought of Woman of the Hour. And stay tuned for another spooky special coming your way before Halloween. As we mentioned earlier on, Allison with a Y and I and another special guest who you'll find out who they are on that episode are going to be digging into all four Jaws movies. We might do them in reverse order just so that we can end on a high note. What seems like it's going to be the sole high note in the franchise, but we'll see what happens there.
We'll see.
Yeah. All right. Stay spoopy. Enjoy the fall Halloween season. For Every Horror Movie on Netflix, I'm Patrick.
I'm Allison with a Y.
And I'm Dr. Katie.
And we will see you next time.